Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Yo, everybody. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today for Medical Monday is Dr. Justin Giuliano. Dr. Giuliano is a radiation oncologist with New York Oncology Hematology at their Clifton Park location, which opened today. Congratulations, everybody. Dr. Giuliano provides all forms of radiation therapy to patients, but has extensive experience in brachytherapy. Brachytherapy?
Yeah, okay.
Or SEEDS treatment, as well as musculoskeletal and central nervous system tumors, gynecologic and genitourinary cancer treatment. Dr. Giuliano earned his medical degree from SUNY Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, completed residencies at both Drexel University and the Cleveland Clinic. Prior to returning to the Capital Region where he grew up, he served as assistant professor of radiology at Penn State, Hershey Medical Center, and was on staff at the Cleveland Clinic Department of Radiology. Dr. Giuliano, welcome.
Thank you, Alan.
So I guess I want to ask you the first question. What is it that you do again?
So we're practicing radiation oncology and utilizing high-energy X-rays for the treatment of various malignant conditions and occasionally some benign conditions as well.
Is this new?
Radiation therapy is not new. In fact, it's been utilized ever since the discovery of radium. So technically, we've had since over 100 years of experience utilizing radiation in some form. Of course, the techniques have been honed, and the technology has advanced to where we are today.
But now, this is what we were talking about before we came on the show. This is really interesting. Now you can have computers which basically take pictures of where the tumor is, right?
Correct. So the treatment devices and the current one that we've just installed called the Varian TrueBeam allows...
Varian TrueBeam.
Correct. TrueBeam. Yep.
Sounds like somebody in the harem, but go ahead.
Well, it allows for us to do what's called onboard imaging. So when a patient's getting positioned for the treatment, it has the capability of taking very high-resolution images to assist in the precise delivery and targeting of the particular tumor in question.
So you have to, I'm probably wrong about this, but what I'm assuming is you've now matched up your computer picture-taking with the aiming of the device.
Absolutely.
So yeah. That's what it is.
And that translates not only into better outcomes, but in fact, actually, less toxicity. Because a lot of the way that which we target tumors is having to account for whether it's positional inaccuracies or tumor motion. And all of this has allowed us to reduce our treatment margins and thereby irradiating less normal tissue. So that translates into our ability to utilize higher doses of radiation as well as offset some of the toxicities that we've seen in the past.
So what sites can we think about? Can you do urinary?
Oh, absolutely. So the beauty of this, and this is true for most linear accelerators. The beauty of them is it allows for the treating of tumors in various sites from the brain, really to the toe, technically.
And you can do the brain?
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
Interesting.
And
does this put you in competition, shall we say, with the brain surgeons or the guys with the knives?
So we actually work complementary. So actually, a lot of progress has been made in the joint efforts between neurosurgeons and radiation oncologists in the management of malignant brain tumors as well as benign brain tumors. In fact, some of our procedures we work hand in hand with a neurosurgeon. I think for the most part, you'll find that a lot of neurosurgeons would like to utilize radiation and our services in cases where there's an appreciation that entering the brain would cause significant harm, which is unfortunately often the case.
Right. This is so interesting, fascinating stuff, because obviously so much of this is new. What kind of level of confidence do we have that it works?
So the reported accuracy, for instance, this the Varian TrueBeam has a quoted accuracy.
That's the machine, the Varian Trubion. I love that.
It has a quoted accuracy of less than 1 millimeter, which is frankly amazing. We've gone from a time where we're
what's a millimeter look like?
Oh, it's the size a pinhead.
Pinhead, okay.
Yeah, and so we've gone from a time where we used to use, let's say, upwards of an inch margin, or just less than an inch, to treat and target tumors. Now, to really being able to hone in on the precise tumor, the actual tumor margin.
Now, have you increased the survival rate by doing this?
So, in some cases, you would say yes. There are some stubborn diseases where, unfortunately, we still face great challenges in terms of tumor biology and such.
What are they?
Going back to the brain, I mean, glioblastomas are a particularly virulent tumor. They're nasty, and as well as there's some others in the abdomen, things like pancreatic cancer, where we struggle with.
Well, I was going to ask you about pancreatic, because if you're taking pictures of things, the big downside on pancreatic is very hard to get into that because it's hiding. Is that right?
Exactly. So some of the imaging characteristics are challenging, and its location is particularly challenging for the treatment with radiation because of its close proximity to very, very sensitive structures. I always describe it to my patients as being precious real estate. And so all of our efforts have to be to minimize the dose to the surrounding tissues, and that's what we're looking to achieve with the advancing technology that we have.
Wow. Do you have to wear a badge to make sure you don't get zapped yourself?
So it's kind of humorous in a way. I mean, we do wear radiation badges, although we hope that we're never exposed, and it's very uncommon for us to be exposed, unlike our diagnostic counterparts who are working under fluoroscopy in the room with the patient all the time.
Yeah.
These are much higher energy X-rays. There's no standing in the room with the patient. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, our standing first guest, Jim from Matamoros. Okay, Jim, you're on. Ask the doctor the question.
I was wondering how sensitive radiation therapy is to leiomyoma or leiomyosarcoma.
That's a great question. So when we think of these musculoskeletal tumors, whether they arise in, let's say, muscle or in bone, they're collectively termed as sarcomas. And the sarcomas are a subset of tumors that are indeed considered to be what maybe a bit of a misnomer, but they're often described as radioresistant. And what that implies is that at the doses that we currently treat with on a daily basis, it's been shown biologically that those tumors are indeed less sensitive. But again, going to the point of having advancements in technology, we're looking to be able to utilize higher doses on an individual fraction basis to overcome that lack of sensitivity. So in select cases, I mean, you need to obviously discuss this with a radiation oncologist, but in select cases, these tumors are very amenable to the use of radiation, both in a preoperative and postoperative timing.
And very quickly on that, doctor, what is the definition of a sarcoma? Is, you said, bone?
Well, sarcomas refer to tumors arising from, let's say, musculoskeletal things, like, let's say, a muscle origin or a bone origin. Like he mentioned a term, leiomyosarcoma, that arises from smooth muscle, as opposed to, let's say, rhabdomyosarcoma, which arises from striated or skeletal muscle. Bone tumors, you might have heard of, or osteosarcomas.
That's very helpful. Thank you very much. Okay, Jim, thanks again.
Okay.
Let's go to Adrian in New Paltz. Okay, Adrian in New Paltz, you're on. Adrian.
Hey, Alan.
Hey.
I wanted to ask the doctor about an NPR story I heard recently, glowing tumor technology. This was mainly brain tumors, and they're so excited about it. It somehow is a protein you inject into the patient. It goes right to the tumor, and they are then able to somehow, like a black light or something, and they are able to light up that tumor. They can see all the tendrils, exactly what they need to cut out, and I wonder if he would comment and see whether that technology is coming soon to other types of tumors.
Coming soon to a tumor near you. Okay, doctor.
Yes, right.
So that's a great question. And this sort of, technology has actually been applied historically. You might think of sentinel lymph node procedures in breast cancers, where we inject in the region of the primary site, as well as melanomas and expanding to other tumor types as well, where we inject adjacent to the primary site. I say we, referring to the surgeons, of course, that are doing this. But oftentimes, these agents that are injected will travel to, let's say, the anticipated or the regional lymph node that would be in its first, what we call the first echelon of drain. And in fact, in those situations, we're using a radiation, radioactive material called, let's say, technetium that can be detected with a camera. And that helps the surgeon target those areas. For these other types of evolving technologies, I think these are all going to have a role in the sense that it's similar to what we're doing in radiation, where we're looking to reduce the margins of treatment. The idea is when you're venturing into, let's say, precious real estate again in the brain, you want to be removing the least amount of tumor as possible. And so the idea that you can have something be broadcasted in a way that the surgeon can see and specifically cut, along with neuromapping to make sure that they're not cutting into vital structure within the brain, makes the surgeries more amenable to getting what we consider to be a gross total resection. And that is very much associated with improved outcomes, particularly in our malignant gliomas. We're looking to get a gross total resection in every case. Depending on the location, though, unfortunately, that's not always possible. But yes, these technologies are critical to our success in the oncology community.
Adrian, thanks for the call. We got to take a break. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Okay. So 1-800-348-2551. We're going to take a short 7-8 second break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, providing comprehensive inpatient and outpatient health care in Schenectady and Southern Saratoga counties. EllisMedicine.org. Ward's Nursery and Garden Center, Great Barrington, where gardeners grow vegetables, creeping phlox, colorful hanging baskets, and flowering trees for spring planting. WardsNursery.com. New York Folklore Society announcing Adirondack Attic, a musical history tour with Dan Berggren and Andy Flynn, sharing folk songs and images from the Adirondacks, May 22nd at 7:30 p.m. in Schenectady. nyfolklore.org for tickets. And from Mass Match, a locally owned dating service connecting both straight and gay singles through private matchmaking in Western Massachusetts and beyond, massmatch.com.
Here we are. We're back with Dr. Justin Giuliano, who is really a marvel, a radiation oncologist with New York Oncology Hematology at their Clifton Park location again, which opened today. I want to congratulate
you
again for this thing. You now, so if you haven't been listening, Dr. Giuliano specializes. You take the picture with the computerized operation, and then you match it with the laser. And this to a point where you're justifying to no more than a pinprick away from where the tumor is. This is extraordinary stuff, and I'm sure that there are many people out there who are either going through something right now or who know somebody who's going through something. Now, remember, this show is always available online at WAMC.org. So if you miss any part of it, you can go there and get the stuff. Okay, we'll go to John in Woodstock. John, you're on.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon, everybody. My question for Dr. Giuliano is, looking to the future, I wonder what he thinks the lifetime of radiation therapy technology will be, given advances in the genetic approach, for instance, using engineered viruses to deliver chemotherapy agents. I'll listen out. Thank you very much.
No, don't go away. Oh. Don't go away. We may want to ask you a question. Go ahead.
Thank you for the question. I think that's a and a very interesting premise, and it's showing great promise. Of course, as of right now, we're making great inroads into sort of understanding tumor biology and such, but obviously significant challenges remain. And one of the challenges is the fact that tumor cells often have the ability to evade our innate immune system, which is actually a very powerful thing. And so you imagine somebody walking amongst you that can't be seen. And so there's a number of these strategies looking to, let's say, vamp up, if you will, and enhance the detection rates of these tumors with or by our own innate immunity. And so that's one particular strategy that does hold promise. In terms of, sort of, let's say, in a way, sort of getting rid of a whole field of oncology at this point, I think in a way, if there was a cure for cancer, let's say tomorrow, I'd be happy to turn in my badge. I mean, I would do that immediately. But unfortunately, and I don't want to sound doom and gloom here, but we've come to understand how complicated it really is. And so I think we have to kind of allow the technology and the biology and these advancements to continue to take place in the same way that for radiation oncology, I've watched an evolution in my since I was 18, and now so we're about 22 years later that we're looking at some of the great advances even within our own field. So effectively, yes, there's indeed room for excitement in terms of some of the technologies and the therapies coming our way, but we have to be mindful of the fact that today we still need to continue the fight.
With the radiation. Yeah. No projected time scales as yet, huh?
Right.
I gotcha. Okay, thank you so much.
And John, FM radio may be doomed because of self-driving cars, but we'll have to find that out.
No kidding.
Well, you're riding down the road and the car drives you. Why not just watch television? You don't have to
watch television. There you
okay,
go.
Thanks a lot, John.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Bye.
Yeah, let's go to Lori in Slingerlands. Lori, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Alan. This is Lori. I'm from Slingerlands, and I wanted to ask the doctor about liver cancer, tumors in the liver, when the person has exhausted every other option of treatment. I know there's the SBRT, the stereotactic body radiation therapy. What does he think of that, and is that really a ditch effort, last resort?
So the integration of stereotactic applications for liver tumors is one that's actually garnered a lot of interest as of late.
So stop, stereotactic is what you do?
Correct.
Okay.
So stereotactic treatments, and oftentimes what the caller referred to, I apologize, I forget her name, Lori.
Sorry.
So she actually used the term SBRT, which I was going to run with, but we probably should back up. And that refers to stereotactic body radiotherapy. And so what you're effectively doing now is taking technology and utilizing very, very high tumor ablative dosing to effectively small regions that are amenable to this therapy. And in looking at this, we've utilized this type of therapy. It first started intracranially, so within the head, a lot of various brain tumors were first targeted in that way. And now the application's gone out into the body. And so with, let's say the Varian True Beam, what the advantage of that particular type of machine is going to have is that it gives, in very short dose rates, the ability to sort of map and match the tumoral motion within the body to deliver high doses of radiation and effectively sterilize these tumors. Now, in the case of liver cancer, it's a great question, but it needs to be addressed in the context of the clinical scenario. So it's hard to answer on a talk show like this, but I would say that seeking a formal opinion from a radiation oncologist would be worthwhile if they're offering those services, potentially. I think the challenge, though, is that we still remain somewhat limited in what we can do, depending on the exact person's native liver function. So it can be challenging just to answer that in a question, but I definitely think that stereotactic body radiotherapies starting to gain some traction in terms of treating upper abdominal tumors.
Now, is liver a bad one?
It can be. It can be very challenging. And the fact is that it's not necessarily very common in the developed countries. It's much more common outside of here.
Well, don't they metastasize from other places to the liver?
So when we think about tumors Yeah, you could describe them as primary or secondary. So primary liver tumors are way less common, certainly, than metastatic tumors. And
So what I'm talking about is mets from the colon.
Yeah, so so oftentimes...
And the person has pretty much exhausted all of his treatment options. So he had just went to MD Anderson for treatment.
Uh-huh.
And... I mean, like, they don't really know, you know, if it's
going to
help.
Yeah. And how unique is what you do, Justin?
So it's actually available. It's not like, let's say, I'm the only radiation oncologist performing
this. So if he's at MD
this.
Anderson, the chances are he's going to...
Oh, absolutely.
Find, yeah.
Yeah, he's going to get a very, very good opinion, and he's being treated there by some brilliant people. I mean, there are definitely some brilliant people at MD Anderson, so... I think he's going to get a fair assessment as to the eligibility, and definitely can get very good treatment there.
Lori, good luck to you. Okay.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Alan. Yeah. Thank you. Bye bye.
Okay. Now we're going to go to Carolyn in Red Hook. Carolyn, you're on.
Hi. My question, he may have covered some of this in the intro, has to do with a type of tumor that is actually benign, apparently very common, grows in the head, apparently grows very fast. Behind, for this person, it was behind her eye. I can't remember the name of it. They couldn't get it all, and they said that there would be a percentage, it could possibly regrow, and they were going to have to do follow-up MRIs regularly. I was wondering how common it was, how often it regrows, if they have any kind of ideas what may cause it. And the last question has to do with tumors and the messaging that they send. I had an oncology breast surgeon tell me that what I had heard was correct, that there's some type of communication, and if you do biopsies, the cancer cells message each other, and it may indeed help the spread.
So in a
Sorry,
sense,
that's multiple.
No, that's a good question. So in terms of the benign brain tumors that arise intracranially, by far the most common one is called a meningioma.
Okay.
And they do come in different flavors. Overwhelmingly, though, the majority of them are what we call low grade as opposed to high grade. So just under... probably under 2% or so are really, frankly, malignant brain meningiomas that, in fact, are very aggressive in terms of their behavior. Nevertheless, all brain tumors, in a way, can be considered aggressive because of their location. You're again coming back to a fixed structure, right? The skull, and
okay.
So anything that's taking up space in the brain. And particularly around behind the eyes and such, you have your the optic apparatus where the optic nerves are and your optic chiasm, so vision can be threatened.
Right.
Now when we address these, of course, here we go again. We're working in a complementary way to surgery, where oftentimes the surgeon, though, when they take it out, they'll send it for pathologic review, and that's where you can get let's say a better understanding of that behavior of the tumor, so you can better forecast the growth rate and such. And,
okay.
And now in that particular location, oftentimes we are offering radiation postoperatively to prevent the growth, because technically we work better when we're dealing with the least amount of disease. So sometimes if we wait too long, then potentially there could be a threat that becomes irreversible.
Radiation versus prednisone, steroid?
Yeah, so steroids you would not necessarily use for unless there was some demonstrable swelling on the brain. We wouldn't use that as a chemotherapy, if you will,
It was used initially before the surgery.
Before the surgery, that's appropriate. Yep.
But
okay.
but benign, Justin, benign can kill you, can it?
So benign, yeah. So it's interesting, right? We uncontrolled benign tumors, because again, they're growing unchecked. They're benign in the sense that they don't have the capacity to spread.
They're not cancerous. Yeah.
But at the same time, they're a space occupying.
Yeah. They don't have the capacity to spread, but they can continue to grow if you don't
Correct.
Get them all.
Yes, they'll grow, exactly. And so because they're taking up space, they can put pressure
on vital things,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. Callan, and then, do they know the cause?
No, actually, there are some relationships to the genetics. Certainly, people who have a history of neurofibromatosis and or family history. Sometimes, when I'm seeing a younger woman, I'll often encourage them to make sure they're up on their yearly mammograms, because there is an association with breast cancer as well. Technically, ionizing radiation is a cause for meningiomas down the road. So
ionizing radiation.
So radiation radiation, whether it's through, let's say, X-rays of in diagnostic and or treatment. Yeah.
Okay, and there was a surgeon, I know a well-known fiddle player who had this, and she had surgery done by somebody who worked under the initial surgeon who developed the procedure, and then later on she had to have a second surgery, which was successful. Do you know the name of that person?
Of the actual neurosurgeon?
Yep.
Oh, gosh, no.
No.
Carolyn,
thank you so much for your help.
No problem.
Okay, bye.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Two free phones now, folks. Let's go to Timothy in Scotia. Timothy.
Good morning, sir, or good afternoon. I'd like to expand on the last one. I have a meningioma. I've been told I've reached my lifetime radiation limit for X-rays, so they're talking about diagnostic MRIs yearly to keep track of it. I had no indication of anything 5 years ago, and it now measures 7 centimeters by 22 centimeters. It seems to be calcified and to have stopped growing. How much of a danger is this? It's right on the surface, on right front lobe surface. It seems to be intruding on the main membrane there or something.
So if you've had treatment both in terms of surgery and radiation?
I've had no treatment for it whatsoever.
Oh, you've had no treatment. And how long have
I have Parkinson's. I'm 63 years old. I have Parkinson's. And I'm already on quite a bit of medication. And it seems to be inactive right now.
Yeah, so I think that the challenge in your particular case, without seeing, of course, the imaging and such, is that a lot of times these meningiomas are fairly characteristic on imaging. They can be made clinically. You don't necessarily need to have surgical confirmation in all cases. The size that you
just... Dr. Genovese.
Yeah, the size that you've described is 22 centimeters intracranially. You know, that's just about the full width of the brain. So that's a fairly sizable tumor. And
I've got to have that. It can't be centimeters. I've got to have that wrong because it appears about the size of a quarter.
Okay. Yeah, that's so with meningiomas, when they're more indolent or they're growing less aggressively, it's not necessarily something that always has to be treated imminently, and so it can be followed to assess the growth rate over time. I just want to go back to one thing that you actually initially called with, just to clarify, because you've not had therapeutic radiation. I don't want to step out of my bounds here, but it's a little bit challenging to say that you've had your lifetime limit of radiation, so that if there was a need for you to have radiation in the future, it really needs to be assessed by a radiation oncologist. So I don't, because you've had a number of diagnostic scans, I don't consider that as being...
Well, I've also had a lot of dental work and a lot of dental x-rays.
Yeah, I know this is definitely a concern that we see
including
in the office.
Including moving this 180 degree moving where
the panoramic moves. Views, yeah.
Panoramic, yes, yeah. That's what I was thinking of.
We see this a lot in our clinics, actually, and you know, I do spend a lot of time reassuring patients that it is indeed appropriate for you to receive treatment when it is appropriate to receive treatment. So I if somebody is recommending that you need to see a radiation oncologist, I would have a careful discussion with them.
And if somebody wanted to get to, hold on, Timothy, if somebody wanted to get in touch with you, Justin, how would they do that?
So that's a great question. Our center just opened today, and so our contact information, our direct office line is 518-831-4434.
Give it to us one more time.
It's 518-831-4434, and that puts patients or prospective patients, I should say, as well in contact with our direct office line, and. And certainly, you know, we're happy to see patients and have a discussion of their effective candidacy for our treatments.
Now, Timothy, we have to let you go because we're up against a hard break. Thank you very much for your call. Very interesting. Appreciate it.
Have a great afternoon. Yep.
Support comes from Nathan Litauer Hospital, welcoming Dr. Alvarez, a gastroenterologist specializing in diseases of the digestive system, practicing in their new endoscopy center in Johnstown, New York, accepting new patients, NLH.org. Monticello licensed real estate broker, 80 Davis Avenue, Albany, utilizing professional photographs, custom websites, and internet marketing to help sell Capital Region homes. MonticelloNYS.com. Cafe Capriccio, offering dining and catering with Tuscan cuisine in Albany, New York, and Neapolitan cuisine in Saratoga Springs. CafeCapriccio.com for reservations. And from the Ashokan Center and the Woodstock School of Art, present Swing and Shine, a dinner and dance with Jay and Molly, swingology and special guests, Saturday, May 16th at 6 p.m., ashokancenter.org.
That is such cool music, Zachary. Thank you very much for that. Appreciate it very much. Okay, so we're back with Dr. Justin Giuliano. We've got three phones, you know, off the hook, and we've got two that you can call on. We'll go to Dick in Longmeadow. Okay, Dick, you're on.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I volunteer in a cancer center 3 days a week and have been for 12 years. But my question is, I have two questions. One is, we have medical physicists, and I see what they're looking at in their screens and so forth. And is I'm just wondering, where is the interface between the radiation oncologist and the medical physicist?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I'm going to expand.
I can't hear you.
No,
I'm sorry.
Can't either. Something's wrong. Okay, go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, perfect.
Okay, so that is actually a great question. So I know the focus is on me today, but the reality is that I'm only as good as my team, and so we have a number of professionals that work alongside of me, including nurses, radiation therapists, and dosimetrists, as well as medical physicists. So there's a robust infrastructure in place that allows me to execute on a day-to-day basis in an effective way. A critical member of that team is indeed a medical physicist. And so much emphasis has been placed at ensuring what we consider to be quality throughout all the processes. And from the actual commissioning and workings of the machine to ensuring the integrity of the machine, right down to an individual person's treatment plan, we are indeed utilizing their services to verify that what I'm prescribing and my intended treatment is actually what's being delivered when the patient's on the table. So, they're sort of the unspoken heroes behind the scenes, whose ties are often askew, but they're actually brilliant people, and great people to work with.
And what do they do?
So, you know, in terms of how they help me directly. So during the radiation treatment planning process, we have professionals called dosimetrists who will take my prescription dose that I've assigned to a target, as well as dose constraints to the normal surrounding structures. And they're going to run a treatment program that effectively dictates to the machine how to operate according to those restrictions. And then a physicist will actually take, so that plan is exported to the treatment unit. A physicist can actually, let's say, for the lack of better terms, they can irradiate a phantom, or let's say a device, as though it's the patient lying there. And that'll generate a report that they can then compare to that which was generated by the treatment plan, and verify that's accurate.
Yeah.
And so we really utilize that in all cases to ensure that really what we think we're delivering is actually what we're getting.
And what degree do they have to have for that?
So they, at a minimum, they have to have an MS,
yeah.
a master's, and then. And you have MS physicists as well as PhD physicists, but I've worked with brilliant people in medical physics.
Dick, great question. Thank you for calling.
May I ask my second question?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Okay, just very quickly, could you just describe the usefulness, or either in treatment or in a diagnostic modality, of a proton beam radiation?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, so the unit that we put in. And we'll have running is called a Varian True Beam, and that utilizes photons for the actual with a pH for the treatment of cancers, and those are effectively X-rays analogous to what you would get when you go for a plain X-ray, just much higher energy. Probably since since the 1950s, there have been other machines in use that actually deliver protons, PR, and those are a charged particle, and felt to have different biologic properties that make certain tumor types, certain tumor types are probably better treated with. In fact, for some of these so-called radio-resistant tumors that we were talking about earlier, there are strategies whereby we can utilize protons for delivering higher biologic effective doses to help control those tumors, things like chondrosarcomas and other tumors that arise at, let's say, the base of the skull. But probably where they've gained more traction recently is in the treatment of pediatrics, in fact, because protons have a unique characteristic in that the energy being transferred, of course, when we're treating, we're utilizing energy. The energy being transferred is over a short distance, and then there's a rapid fall off, so that the contribution of dose beyond the tumor is markedly decreased. And so in children, of course, that means that there's less normal tissue. Let's say if you're treating a spine, less normal tissue being irradiated, which can have important implications for the development of secondary tumors down the road. So protons are a very, very expensive modality. When we were talking about the cost of these machines before, a proton facility runs in about the $250 million range.
Whoa! And these ones, the ones you're using now, are $3 million.
Yeah, three, somewhere, and maybe if all dressed up, they get up to five or something. But
$250.
Yeah,
can you afford one?
No. So what ends up happening is, no, I definitely cannot afford it.
I don't mean personally.
No, I was just kidding. So there are a number of these centers going up, but the challenge is that, you know, there's sort of a unique segment of patients that they're really most appropriate for and have shown the most benefit for. So whether or not that changes with time will remain to be seen. But for much of what we see in our office on a day-to-day basis, it does not confer any significant advantage.
So, Dick from Long Meadow, we're going to have to let you go. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We probably can fit in two or three more. So let's go to Edward in Cheshire. Okay. Edward in Cheshire, you're on.
All right. I think this comes under the rubric of hypothetical. But I'm curious about it. I, amongst millions, I believe, have arthritis, and I'm wondering if there isn't any radiation therapy that could eliminate arthritis.
now you're thinking. You know, in fact, actually, radiation has potent anti-inflammatory properties, in the sort of broad utilization of radiation for arthritis, I would say that we're up against the fact that it remains a benign condition, and so where radiation, unfortunately, in a very small percentage of cases can induce secondary tumors down the road because it is a carcinogen. It generally has not been explored for the use, let's say, in the treatment of arthritis. It can be used in some benign diseases. We were talking about meningiomas earlier, and In Europe, there's more experience in utilizing it for things like plantar fasciitis and other types. My caution is that you know, with arthritis being a disease of the joints too, that you know, radiation can cause scarring down the road and limitations, let's say, in the actual flexibility or mobility of the structures at hand, and so, you know, I can't. I'm just speaking off the cuff a little bit, but the challenge there would be is that you're rating in a large number of patients, as you say, and while the overall incidence of secondary cancers is very small, it will develop a sort of magnitude that would be otherwise unacceptable. And then two, even if it proves efficacious, the other thing is that you have the challenge of the joint being a somewhat limiting issue. In fact, we do everything we can to spare joint spaces as it is now when we're treating our malignant types to avoid those functional limitations later on. But that's a great question.
Interesting. I've got another second question, okay, which has just popped into my head, thinking. A tumor, one of the things you do with a tumor is try to isolate it from the non-negative aspects of the body. How about developing a balloon-like structure which could surround the designated tumor and then squeeze it to death?
That's actually, so let's put it this way. If I could surround the tumor in that capacity, then I wouldn't have to squeeze it. There are a number of things that I could do to it.
Or isolate it so that it can't live.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, there's the, you know, part of what we're doing always is looking for means of really distancing the normal tissues from the tumor at hand. And so, for instance, when we're using radiation, there are times where we'll take advantage of the ability to use space occupiers and such to try and maximize the distance between the tumors and normal tissue. But unfortunately, getting around a tumor in that capacity would just mean that you would have had the ability to just effectively excise it, and that would have obviated the need for anything else, right?
Okay,
All right. No answer. Bye.
You're done. Thank you.
Thank you.
No answer. I feel bad.
No, that's unbelievable. It was a very good answer, Doctor. I don't want you to feel anybody's rudeness is appropriate here. Okay, let's go to Anne in Clifton Park. Anne, you're on.
Hello. I was wondering if the doctor could explain surgery that's referred to as RPLND to remove tumors that are not tumors, swelling lymph nodes.
Yeah. So an RPLND just refers to a retroperitoneal lymph node dissection, and it just so happens that the lymph nodes that live in the retroperitoneum.
And where is that again?
So that's effectively in the abdomen, let's say, but that's not really right because it's the retroperitoneum. So it's not in your abdominal cavity proper, but actually, let's say where your kidneys live, and it's sort of in a different location.
Okay.
But the easiest to think of paraspinal, like adjacent to the spine. So when addressing the retroperitoneum, there are different tumor types that indeed spread to that region. And so it'll often warrant the use of surgery in that sense to remove the lymph nodes, whether or not they're involved. Oftentimes we'll do that to effectively do what we call staging the patient and having a better understanding of where the disease has spread to and what it actually is involving. So it can be both therapeutic as well as diagnostic. And so an RPLND can be used in the initial workup of a patient, or if there's disease that's spread there, they can also do it in testicular cancers. For instance, it's commonly used to remove post-chemotherapy residuals.
So, yes. Isn't it considered radical, though? Is there a less radical treatment?
That's a hard... I mean, I would say that technically, in the same way that we've had advances in our technology from a radiation standpoint, I would say that surgeons have been benefited by minimally invasive techniques that afford them, you know, great latitude and the ability to actually successfully carry out these procedures with a lot less morbidity than previous. Now, again, there's a challenge there that needs to be discussed with a surgeon. If you've had a number of prior abdominal surgeries, and depending on body habitus and things like that, that can pose challenges for the surgeon themselves. But I would say that there is technology that has allowed for optimizing those outcomes as well.
And we have to let you go. I'm so sorry.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot. Justin, if I can, I want to ask you a question. A lot of people say, okay, go to New York City, go to the, you know, Columbia Presbyterian, go to this or that. Is that right? Are you better off going to the city than doing it up here?
So I think you have to have a careful discussion with your providers. If it's certainly something that warrants a treatment, in fact, that's not ability to be offered in the local community, then it's
like the $250 million.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, if your radiation oncologist is I mean, technically you're soliciting their opinion as to whether or not they're eligible for the treatment that you have when you're seeing them. So they should be the one serving as your advocate and arranging appropriate therapies if it's not able to be offered locally. There are select cases that are definitely better served in a major medical multimodality setting. Although I got to be honest with you, with the available technology out there, it's that sort of notion that you absolutely have to go to a larger medical center is probably less significant, I would say.
That's good. Okay, Susan in Red Hook, and this is going to be the last one. Susan in Red Hook, you're on, and it's got to be short. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to ask the doctor, I was recently diagnosed with, or actually presented at the emergency room after having a headache for 45 days, and my blood pressure was 219 over 109. And I went to a cardiologist the next day, MRI and MRA, and the only thing that they found, they were suspecting a pheochromocytoma. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And the only thing that they found was a small pituitary tumor, I think 8 centimeters. And they said, well, that's probably not causing the high blood pressure and the headaches. And then I subsequently went to a neurologist and then to an endosurgeon.
Susan, we're running out of time. I mean, really running out of time.
And I wanted to ask what he thinks about the pituitary tumor, that it, you know, that they don't think that's causing it. So they don't know what's causing it.
Actually, what you've heard sounds appropriate. I'm disinclined to think that the pituitary tumor is causing those issues, but again, you really need to speak with your, and continue the care with your current providers.
Susan, I'm so sorry. We're out of time, and I just am just glad we got everybody in. I want to thank Dr. Justin Giuliano. You were terrific today, Justin.
Thank you.
Appreciate it for joining us. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell for answering the phones. Our producers, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok, reminding you, you can't hear a program like this if you don't put anything into the lockbox. So I want everybody to go to the lockbox right now and put something in. I don't care what it is. It could be $5. Go to WAMC.org. It could be $5,000. But think about it. Just if somebody got their life saved right now. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at WAMC.org/Vox Pop. And we have a wonderful news program coming up, so stay tuned now.